Welcome to Rewatchable, episode 189, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, season 4, episode 22, Restless, and Angel, season 1, episode 22, To Shanshu in LA. We are at the season premiere of Buffy season 4 and Angel season 1, which is a very exciting time.
Finale, not premiere.
Did I say that? Yeah. well, you know. Anyway, the finale. Yeah, it's a very exciting time for both Buffy and Angel. Both of the shows have sort of reached a bit of a turning point, and we'll get into talking about why both of those episodes were important and what we can say, you know, spoiler-free about what's to come and the journey so far, etc., etc. I'm very excited to get into this discussion because I love both of these episodes. My name is Selena. I'm here with my fellow superfan, Caitlin, and newbies, Kristen and Danielle, who very gracefully agreed to join us again. So welcome, everyone.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. Welcome. So before we get into the discussion, as always, we want to remind you of the contact information. You guys have been really great about getting in touch, especially recently, and we love hearing from you. So make sure you keep sending in all your thoughts on Buffy, spoiler-free, and Angel and the podcast by either emailing rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com, tweeting at re_watchable, going to this post on hypable.com, which is hypable.com in the podcast section, or finding us on Tumblr at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. And we look forward, as I said, to hearing from you. Fun facts to help you discover our voices and distinguish them even. Let's start with Danielle.
Sure. So instead of watching the Gilmore Girls revival, like I feel like everybody else in the world is, instead of starting that, I actually started watching Search Party on TBS. It's the show, it's like a 30-minute episode show. They show two a night, and they've been like marathoning them, and they have them already on demand. But it's, I think her name is Alia Shawkat from Arrested Development. And it's all about this girl who goes missing, and this girl who barely knows the missing girl kind of takes it upon herself to go and figure out what happened to her. And it's really interesting so far. It takes like the best and worst parts of the HBO show Girls, which is both frustrating and entertaining at the same time. But so yeah, I've been watching that instead of Gilmore Girls.
Oh, fun. Are you not a Gilmore Girls fan, or are you just savoring it?
I was when it was first on, but I've been trying, like, it's been on recently, or I'll change the channel, it'll be on, and I can't sit for more than about 5 minutes of it anymore. I don't know if it's because I'm like jumping into the middle of the series in like a random episode. It's just, so I will watch the revival at some point. I just don't know how I'm going to feel about it yet, because I don't know if it's my, if it speaks as much to me anymore as it used to.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm watching all of Gilmore Girls. Obviously, we're doing for Hype, the Hypables podcast Hype, we're doing these fast speed rewatches, and I've been watching it all for the first time, and like, it's so interesting to watch whatever it is, this show from this period of time, like the late 90s or early 2000s, because TV was just like a different beast back then. And like, in retrospect, like, there's so many things you could say about Gilmore Girls, like, if you wanted to, but I've really been enjoying the experience and sort of getting that slice of pop culture that I really felt like I was missing. I'm like a newbie of Gilmore Girls, if you will. So, but I was actually, my plan was actually to watch, like, to stay spoiler free for like all of it. But Twitter and Facebook are just flooded with spoilers already. Like, it's everywhere. Like, the last four words and who everyone ends up with and all of that. So I'm just like, I may as well watch it and not be spoiled all by all that. So since I'm in the groove, I might as well keep going. My fun fact was actually going to be that I went to a Monet exhibition this weekend. And I'm a fan. I'm totally in the Monet fandom, you guys. No, I really love Monet. It's one of my favorite painters. And I got to see some of the absolute greatest paintings, and the water lilies and the bridges and all of that stuff. So that was really exciting. The art geek inside of me was very happy. So yeah, that was my fun fact. Very, very nice weekend. Kristen, how about you?
Mine is going to be that on Wednesday, right before Thanksgiving, I took my niece and my mother and it was really good fun. We went and saw Moana, and I have to say, oh, I freaking love it. It's so good. The music is fantastic, and like the whole story is just really, really fun, and it's so beautiful. The movie is really, really pretty, and yeah, so Moana, big thumbs up for me.
Oh, that's so awesome. I really want to see that. It comes out in February here, though, so I have to wait a long time.
Yeah, it's really good. It'll be worth really it.
Cool. Oh, good. And Caitlin, what's your fun fact?
So my fun fact is that I have been decorating for Christmas. I put up my Christmas tree on Friday, and poor Gage, my pup, is not sure what to do with it, though he adapts quickly, and after half a day of being terrified of the tree, he's now like sleeping under it. So,
that's so cute.
He's resilient.
That's amazing. And he is like your Christmas present.
I know. I keep looking at him and being like, did Santa come early?
That's adorable. Oh my gosh. It's such an early to have your Christmas tree already. It's crazy. I don't start decorating until the first.
Oh, but I've started.
Christmas lasts longer.
I was going to say, I've started decorating. I just don't have the tree up. I'm waiting for Karen to return before I do that.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So it's time to talk about Buffy, season 4, episode 22, Restless, which was the season finale, not premiere, of season 4, a very, I think, universally not very beloved season, although I think this rewatch in particular sort of made me find new appreciation. I've never really liked it much, but this time I was like, ooh, there's actually some really good episodes in it. And of course, Restless is, like, spoiler alert, my personal favorite episode of the whole series. I know it's not everybody's, though it does tend to creep up there on a lot of lists, but it's a very different sort of episode. It's a, obviously the big showdown with Adam happened last week. That was sort of more of a traditional big battle or big bad, whatever that word is, like destroying finale, and the decision of Joss Whedon to sort of turn it way down into something completely different was like actually partly made because they realized that the Adam and Initiative storyline wasn't working very well. And I think Joss Whedon even said that like that scene of Xander in the bathroom was like the best use of the Initiative they'd had all year. So I think that says a lot of that. But anyway, we have a lot to talk about with this very interesting episode. But I guess just to catch everyone up, the brief synopsis from Ariana reads, in this weird AF episode, the First Slayer invades the Scooby Gang's dreams and tries to kill them all until Buffy embraces the spirit of colonialism and realizes that she makes her own magic. So, I mean, first of all, Caitlin, I wanted to ask, how does this finale fall for you? Are you into it? Are you not a fan? How does it land?
Prior to this rewatch, I've never liked it all that much just because I always felt like it went over my head a little bit. But after rewatching it and reading a whole lot of deconstructions about all the foreshadowing and symbolism, I have a new appreciation for it that I did not before. But it's a weird one, and it sort of is I can see why you said premiere, because it is kind of leading into season 5 very much.
Premiere of a new season.
Yeah, it doesn't really fit season 4 as much as season 5.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I've always, like, the reason I like it so much and is always because I felt like it added something more, like, more substance to season 4, because the reason I like season 4, despite, like, all the things that are to not like about season 4, is because I feel like it's very clearly, like, the deconstruction and rebuilding of the core group. Like, it opens with them none of them knowing how they fit into this world anymore, and all of them trying to find their place, and some episodes like the fear itself showing all of their fears about fracturing, and we see them slowly fall apart, and then they fall apart in what's that episode? The Yoko Factor. And then they sort of, they build themselves back up. And this episode is sort of taking it back to like diving into them. Like, this is the point of Buffy the show. And that's also, if you don't like the characters of Buffy, you're probably not going to like the show Buffy, because this is at the center of everything. This is who these characters are, and this is what the show is all about. So in that sense, I feel like if Restless hadn't been there, season four would have been terrible. But because Restless is there, I feel like the rest of the season sort of suddenly makes a lot more sense, because it's all been building not to Adam, but to this. So in that sense, I guess it does kind of, I feel like it does fit season four more, but at the same time, it's like season four ended in Primeval, and now we are back to what the show, at least in my opinion, should be about, which is these four characters and their inner lives. But newbies, Danielle and Kristen, what was it like watching this episode for the first time in 2016?
I hated it. I can appreciate what was trying to be done. You were talking about the characters and their relationships to each other. I didn't feel like that was done well enough for me to like this episode. Like when they fell apart in the Yoko Factor, I thought it was interesting, but it felt like they came together far too quickly after that without really going into a lot of their issues. At least that's how it felt to me. It felt a little too easy. And so when we got to this episode, it kind of felt just like a rehashing of everything that we knew was wrong. And I just kept waiting for, I guess, a new spin or like new information on what each character was going through. And it never really went there for me. So like everything that happened in their dreams, I was like, yes, I know this makes sense, but what else are you trying to do with it? So it didn't do much else for me. And it felt just really out of place because it didn't take a step forward. I would be interested in reading all of those deconstructions after we finish the whole series. So I might tap you for that, Caitlin, once everything is done.
Yes, definitely.
I do. Well, yes.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
100%. I'm not going to jump into it now. But I really enjoy doing things like that. And I think I could get a better appreciation for it then. But it didn't do anything for me.
How did you feel about it, Kristen?
I have a love-hate relationship with, like, dream episodes when it comes to shows. Like, every so often you get one that really lets you into their heads, and it gives you a really good snapshot at who they are and you know, what is going on in their brain that you don't already know. I don't feel like this necessarily gave us a lot of insight, as much as like it just felt really random. Like, dreams feel random, and I loved how like they'd be in one scene and then they'd walk and you were in a new room. Like, that felt very dreamlike and was really kind of really well done. But like the actual like content of each little scene didn't necessarily make me think more about the characters. I was trying so hard to like see what was on screen and like try to understand what about it was like personal to them or like why they were dreaming it, that I think I may have been trying too hard to see something and just never ended up really catching all of it anyway. So it's a love-hate relationship. Like, it's not a bad episode. There is a lot in there, but if you don't necessarily know everything that you're looking for, it can feel like overwhelming.
What, just out of curiosity, what are some of the dream episodes that you feel like give you what you want from an episode like that?
Of course, I can't think of any specifically. Like, shows have done this before where they take you into a character's dream world and you get a chance to see it. Of course, I'm not going to be able to think of one. Like, this isn't really the same thing, but there's an episode of Dawson's Creek where they relive the day from, like, 10 different perspectives, and in each, like, every time they restart the story, every time you see the same scene you've already seen, you know, three times from a different mm-hmm. point of view, you get something more from it. Like, you understand something more about what's going on. And so, like, here, trying to get more out of it, like, it's just hard because most of these little scenes were either in places we have never been or in or with people we hadn't really, you know, seen or people that didn't necessarily matter. Like, we had the core group, but there was so much else going on.
I'm sorry, how is that? That was like literally only the main characters were in these dream sequences.
We had the initiative tacked on into one scene and I have no idea why they were there. We were like randomly in the desert or randomly in on the swing set. Like that, I liked that scene, but like, we don't really spend any time in like the desert or in the swing set or whatever. So trying to figure out what that means is really complicated. I'm trying to sort through all of this, but like there were like random groups of people that would pop up that, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean anything if it just fits the scene that there's other people there. Like when Giles is singing and, you know, they're in the club or whatever, but what is with all of it? Like, just trying to get a greater sense of it is really confusing.
Yeah. You know, it's always funny to, like, to deconstruct these kinds of episodes, since you sort of have this, always just feels like there's this underlying sense that because it's not immediately clear, it's somehow bad, which is something that I, you know, when I talk about Gilmore Girls, is something that I try very hard not to do, just because I feel like, you know, anyway, it doesn't matter. I think that one of the things that I really love about stuff like this, and I think one of the reasons why this is sort of like the epitome of television to me, the stuff that Buffy does, is because I actually kind of like that things don't always make sense on the first watch. Like, I enjoy watching something knowing that I don't have all the pieces yet, but trusting that the show will sort of give that to me. And I think a lot of times, like, I don't like shows that where I don't trust that they give me those pieces. So maybe like part of the thing with Buffy is that if you sort of like don't trust that the story will make sense, an episode like this definitely won't feel as meaningful.
Well, I think,
but I trust it and I like it. So that matters too, I guess.
I think my biggest problem with it is like, nothing specifically from these dreams is super memorable for me, besides like maybe Spike and Giles on the swing set, which I just found hysterical. Like, there's not a lot of it that I'm going to remember as a first-time yes. watcher. So it's hard to find the meaning in things that I can't even remember. And that's, like, having watched it 3 or 4 times, I'm sure you can get way more meaning out of this episode. But on a first watch, it's really hard to see in the random.
Okay, but I watched it for the first time once too, so I think like it's just sometimes having different opinions, we have to be careful that we, you know, we take that into consideration too.
Do you think, so in talking about how it's giving you the pieces, do you think it's giving you pieces that you will remember down the line, or is this something that requires a rewatch? Because I'm not necessarily that's sure that question. I would go back and rewatch it. That's kind of two separate two separate things. Where is he depending on us to want to go back and rewatch? Because I don't know at this point in time if that was really a thing.
That's a really, really good question. Mm-hmm. I think that's because that is one of the things. And honestly, like, I think it's a little bit of both. Like, I think if you come into the show, like, and we have to remember too that Buffy was a cult show. So at this point, I think a lot of people probably felt like some of the newbies might feel like, oh, maybe this isn't a show for me. So it did have a relatively small audience. So I think the people that had stuck with it, and Caitlin, you can correct me on this too. Like, I felt like they came into this wanting an episode that, and probably saw some of the things, and those are some of the things we're going to get into in the discussion too, but probably saw some of the deeper things about the characters. But also once, you know, it does reward the rewatch. And that is something about Buffy that I personally love, but I realize that not everybody loves that. But I feel like I feel like Buffy is more like, if you're reading Harry Potter, for example, and you get to the halfway point of Philosopher's Stone and you go, this sucks, I have no idea why Snape is evil or why Harry's parents died, and I don't know who this Dumbledore dude is, this is ridiculous, whatever, close the book, and then you're done, right? Whereas obviously once you've read it all, you're like, oh, that all makes sense. And so I feel like, does that make sense? Like, I feel like Buffy is a slightly different experience from your average TV show. So maybe that's like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but it is a really good question. I'm wondering what you think about that, Caitlin.
I'm not entirely sure what you were trying to say either. So what's the question?
Danielle's question.
Yeah, my question is, in keeping with Selena's idea that you get the gratification for this episode down the line, like it gives you pieces that you can go back and think about and appreciate more once you're further, are the pieces more gratifying? Is it required for a rewatch to get those pieces and feel good about them? Or is it something that they gave you the pieces that are like giant things that stick out in your mind so that you do remember them when you're still on your first watch down the line? So is it something that requires a rewatch in order to understand more or appreciate more? Or will I get it by not rewatching it and just keeping on with the show and not going back later?
Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I would say that there is a fair amount in this episode that deals with everything that the characters have been through and is setting up the Slayer mythology that I feel like you should be able to understand, deal with right now. And there are bits that foreshadow seasons 5, 6, and 7 that on rewatch make it even richer. But knowing that that was always in the works, seeing those seeds planted. But I think there is plenty in this episode that does not necessarily require a rewatch to grapple with. And I think we'll talk about a fair amount of it. But it is presented in a very kind of confusing way. So I'm hoping that talking about it will help a great deal.
I agree. And that is obviously we're not even begun the discussion points yet, so we should probably start deconstructing it a little bit. But basically the way I see it, and I think the way that it was meant to be seen, and not necessarily that that's always successful, but is that it's kind of like a surrealist movie. You know, like you watch it the first time, you're like, what the hell did I watch? This is so stupid. And people are like, this is genius. And you're like, either I'm stupid or they're stupid. It has to be one of the two. Then you watch it again, or you read something, you like deconstruct it. You're like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Or you're just like, that's ridiculous. Why is this called art? Why is this good TV? I have no idea what's happening. So, and this is the kind of episode that probably divides the waters for those reasons. And I think, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter who likes it or not, but I will say that the fact that I, when I watched it for the first time, I had no idea what half the stuff meant. I loved that because I was also younger, so I didn't think too much about it. I was just like, well, it'll make sense down the line. Then it did make sense down the line. And now every time I go back and rewatch Restless, I pick up something new. Like every single time I've picked up something that I didn't see before. And I love that. Like, I love that. But if you don't love that, then you're probably not going to love it. And you're probably not going to love Buffy the show. And that's totally fine. And I think at the end of the day, it's pretty common that you know, the people that are fans feel differently than those that aren't. But anyway, we have so much to get through and I don't want to stall any longer, but I do want to say, actually kind of related to this, I did have a quote that I wanted to read out from, Critically Touched, which is probably one of the places you went for some deconstruction, Caitlin. I also read some stuff before this episode because I wanted to be prepared. And the person who critically touched on this episode of Buffy wrote, what is so special about this dream episode anyway? Some people think it's just an artistic gimmick. Others think it's great just because of the cheese man. Well, I see this as special because it's the nexus of the entire series. It's a character study of the core Scoobies, Buffy, Willow, Xander, and Giles, where their past, present, future are seamlessly woven together to form a textured perfection. We are reminded of where these characters began, where they currently are, and where they're heading with truckload of cryptic foreshadowing. That makes this an episode which caps everything that has come before it and sets up everything that is to come after it. So I guess that kind of to Kristen's point, it is kind of like, or Danielle's point, both of your points, it is kind of an episode that sums up like the characters so far. But I think from my, like, I'm just happy, you know, seeing how much, like how much Josh really knows his characters and how much he's aware of their journey and how closely their journey ties to who they are at the core of their being. And this is a perfect time to go into talking about Willow, who, in my opinion, had the best, Well, it's hard to pick a best, but I think she had the best dream sequence. At the end of the day, Willow dreams about, there's a lot of parts of Willow's dream sequence that we can pick out and deconstruct. But I think the most important thing for me is the constant arc of Willow feeling like she has to hide, you know, feeling like she's in a costume, putting herself in a ridiculous production of Death of a Salesman, us being like calling back all the way to season one and Madame Butterfly. People saying, you know, they will find out who you really are. And then comes the big reveal in the classroom where it turns out that her true self is still the quote unquote old Willow from high school. I really love this because I think it says something about Willow's journey so far, how even though on the surface she has progressed a lot, she still feels like she is this quote unquote nerd that she was in season one, and this person that she feels like come through, or she wasn't enough, basically. And it's actually something that I wanted to ask what you guys thought of, because I think there are different interpretations of this. When, you know, that line, they will find out about you, I think it was Tara who said it. If you think that relates more to her new confidence being like a mask, or is it about something else? Like, are we looking at a Willow who is trying to hide who she really is, being a nerdy loser from high school, or is who she really is something different entirely?
I read it as her being afraid that that's who she still is. Like, I think she recognizes that, you know, those parts of herself, but I think there's very much of like being afraid that the progress that she's made is not real. Mm-hmm. And so when she's saying like, I need it, about the outfit that she's wearing being a costume, is kind of like, if I don't wear this, I can't, you know, be who I am today. But I think, you know, her development has been pretty natural, minus the whole like magic stuff, which is magic and not natural. But like, you know, I feel like in the waking world, like, it's a very natural development for her. But I think for her, it's a whole lot of insecurity, and that, that she's afraid that people are going to real, because she very much has found kind of her niche in college with Tara doing more magic. Like, she's really found a place that like she kind of fits, which she never did in high school. And that a lot of her dream calls back to her high school years, I think, is kind of her insecurities rising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's super interesting. I think it's like, ultimately, at the end of the day, it's a lot of things. It's Willow being afraid of them, like of not having changed. I think it's such a universal fear. Like, I feel like we all kind of go through life. We have some successes. Maybe we find like a significant other, and we have this. If you're like not a confident person, you go around with this fear of, what if they figure out that I'm really not good enough?
Imposter syndrome.
Like,
Willow has imposter syndrome.
It has a name.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's like, and that is a real thing. And I'm glad you put a name to it. But I think that comes across so well in this episode. And it does, in my opinion, it does reward some of her development, because I do feel like, while I agree with you that it has been natural, I also think, you know, and I put Doppelgangland on here to remind myself that ever since Doppelgangland, ever since meeting her confident vampire self, like, I feel like Willow has made a conscious effort to change. And I think we've seen that, you know, when she came to university, like, she was different. She made herself be different. She found a new confidence, and somewhere inside of her, she's unsure of whether that's real or not. And I think that's very extremely relatable. I also think it has to do with, obviously, with her new relationship with Tara. I think it might have something to do with the magic that she's doing and how that's changing her, her approach to things. I don't know if Kristen or Danielle, if you have any thoughts on that.
I totally agree with the imposter syndrome. would not have put that title on it because I couldn't formulate my thoughts that well. But I understand exactly where that is because that's how I feel. And it's kind of like the progression that she has made, like Caitlin was saying, is natural in the real world. But when you kind of take a look at yourself and see where your two endpoints that you set down are, they seem very different. And so it seems very strange that that's the way that you would have gone. And I definitely think the vampire Willow helped her because it's sort of like in time travel shows, if someone, their person from the future shows up, you see kind of what your possibilities are. And so because Willow saw that this was a possibility for her, I think it helped her give herself more options for who she could be. And it pushed her that way. But if you are Willow and you're looking back on that point from the point in the future, it still seems kind of weird because that wasn't your original range of options. So, yeah, I totally agree with that line of reasoning.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that. And I love the also the whole Oz coming back and him being in her dream was just such a natural thing. And him flirting with Tara, I think it's also touches on that very universal sort of fear of not being enough and the two of them finding each other because she was not good enough for either of them. Like, I think it's all so, like, they managed to put that on screen so well. Like, every time I watch it, I'm like, oh my God, that's me. That's how I feel. And I think a lot of people feel that way. And then I guess the last question I had for her sequence is that, do you think, and maybe this is just me sort of reading too much into it, but do you think there's a point to be made that Willow, like, that, I don't know what I'm trying to ask. I guess that she fears that she will revert to the season one Willow, or is that really who she is at the core of herself? Like, when you strip the magic and the clothes and everything away, like, is she truly trying to hide something, or has she truly progressed? Does that make sense? Maybe that doesn't make any sense.
No, I think that makes sense. I don't think that she will revert, although I do think that she will do some sort of introspection. I mean, we all have these sort of identity crises. And I think, trying to think back, I think I had one around the same age as Willow is now. I also had one last year. So, like, they happen. And so I think more than reverting, it'll be kind of like, where am I now? Are there things about that I am not comfortable with? Are there things that maybe I want to do differently, and then go from there? I don't think it'll be a reversion, just because she doesn't strike me as the type of person to, I guess, not learn from mistakes or not learn from things that she has gone through. And I think the things that you go through make you who you are. So you can't really go, she will not go back, I don't think.
Right. Okay. And then I guess the very final thing I had for Willow was actually, I just wanted to remark on how the concept of a real name kind of recurs for in this episode, and it, how, you know, in the beginning we had Willow drawing on Tara's back, and we saw the Miss Kitty Fantastico cat, which I take to represent the First Slayer, and Buffy, like, the Slayer. And when Tara says, or Willow says, someone says that she's not fully grown, sort of representing how she hasn't discovered her true power yet. And Tara herself, like, you know my real name. Like, I feel like there's such a concept here of, who are you really? Like, at the core of yourself, what are you? Who are you? What are you about? And I think that, you know, it obviously relates to the Slayer, but it also relates strongly to Willow and Tara. And I don't really know how much I can say about it, except to say that I found it really fascinating.
I would also point out that Willow dies getting her life sucked out of her, and she was the spirit in the joining spell.
Yes. Yeah. If you guys hadn't picked up, I mean, that feels pretty obvious, but if you guys hadn't picked up on it, obviously Xander has his heart ripped out because he was the heart, and Giles has his brain cut out because he was the mind, and Buffy, like, has her hand chopped at. So it was a pretty nice bit of continuity there, I guess. So moving into Xander's dream, which I also found, I think this was the longest dream sequence. And I think that kind of, for me, that kind of represents that Xander is probably the character that has the most contradicting things going on inside of himself right now. He's sort of like, all of the characters are at a crossroads, and we'll get back to that a little bit later. But Xander is probably the one whose crossroad is the clearest. You know, he, everything in his dream leads back to the basement, to his, the threat of this father figure that we've never seen from Xander before, who is this presence in his life that we've only ever heard about. This, you know, it implied to be abusive and dangerous to him. Everyone in Xander's dream makes some kind of reference to being ahead of him. Buffy says, I'm way ahead of you. Willow says, I'm way ahead of you. Giles says, Buffy and Willow went on ahead. You know, for Xander, it's all about being stuck and finding ways to move forward. And I think, you know, and even the dream sequence when he's dreaming in French, which, by the way, is another super relatable dream thing. It's all about him being lost and left behind, getting lost in Buffy's house. Like, there's so much symbolism here. Some of it really obvious, some of it really, really subtle, that points to Xander being at a point of his life when he knows that he's lost and out of the loop, and him having to catch up, basically, in one way or another. And first of all, I'm wondering how you guys felt about Xander's dream sequences overall, if there were any particular points that stood out to you. And maybe Kristen?
Like, the scene that stands out most in my mind is, I kind of mentioned it, the playground, and, like, the idea of Spike kind of being Giles, like, little, you know, his protege, and Buffy just kind of randomly playing in the sandbox, which I'm not sure I entirely understand. And, like,
well, that was a reference to the sorry to interrupt you. That was a reference to the desert that came later.
Well, right. Yeah. Like, I knew once we got her in the desert later, I kind of put that together. But at that time, like, it was like, I'm not really sure why she's in the sandbox, but okay. But, like, yeah, that sequence kind of stands out. Maybe it's just because, like, seeing Spike it through Xander's eyes as, like, you know, someone that Giles sees potential in, like, maybe that's something that Xander feels like nobody sees in him, and that if Giles can see it in Spike, then, you know, like, what the hell am I doing here kind of thing. I don't know. That sequence kind of stood out for me. The other that stands out just for being, like, shocking was, like, him walking into the bathroom and then looking to the left, and the initiative is all standing there just because it's like, hi.
But, yeah. That was really funny. Or interesting, I guess. But that scene though, with Buffy in the pretty big sandbox and Giles and Spike on the swings, like, it reveals so much, not just about Xander's relationship or lack of relationship with Giles. You know, I think, you know, we've seen through the whole show that Xander and Giles's relationship has always been on the verge of content. Like, Giles has never respected Xander. He's never liked Xander. He kind of felt like the newbies have felt about Xander, you know, that why is he here? He's kind of the scum of the earth, but he's Buffy's friend, so I have to put up with him. And this, I think, shows Xander sort of acknowledge, because we've even seen that, you know, Spike having to stay with Giles and then having to stay with Xander. Like, Xander's like, why are we spending so much time with this guy? Like, Xander, it's some kind of contempt that we're seeing here played out, and even an acknowledgement of the fact that he's never going to be Giles's protege. You know, he said, yeah, I was into that for a while, referencing the Watcher stuff. Like, maybe he had a dream of that once, but that ship has sailed, that swing has swung. And then there's Buffy's, you know, she's sitting there in the sandbox again, sort of referencing to the later Giles's dream, where she's also very childlike. And she says, way ahead of you, big brother. And I think, for me, it's a very strong moment for this character, because it's also, you know, he has, like Xander, and I guess boys in this universe are want to do, like, he has sex dreams about his friends and his friends' mothers, but he doesn't of Buffy. And then there's this line of big brother. Like, I think in Xander's mind, like, finally, Buffy is family to him. She is no longer like this object of abstract attraction. She's something else to him, and them sort of ending up in the ending the scene staring at each other, and then it cuts to the other Sander driving away with Anya, I think is sort of meant to symbolize that even further. And I really appreciate that, because I think it shows a lot of growth on Sander's part. And of course you can question what the big brother, like, big, why is he a big brother? What does that mean? I have some theories about that, but I won't get into them now. Caitlin, did you pick up on, or did you have anything to add to that?
Well, I would say, I think you can also read the big brother as resentment that she never had any attraction to him. Like, within the second episode of the show, she was already saying, like, you're one of the girls. So, you know, in a dream.
Oh, right. So reading it more like, mm-hmm.
In a dream where he has sex dreams about all the other girls he knows, basically, mm-hmm. It almost seems like, I don't know if I necessarily read it that way, but I feel like that's a different interpretation of him having subconscious frustration that he was never able to be an object of sexual interest for Buffy, and has always been this brother figure to her.
I like that one too. Like, I think I've never really sort of considered that, because I think I view Sander's growth or development in the series like slightly differently from that. But that's certainly a valid way to look at it too. I think there's some evidence in the text that it's him coming to see her as a sister or family. But that's also maybe looking a little bit ahead. So we'll stick with that one. And then, you know, sort of again touching a little bit on the sex dream and how the WB still wasn't allowing them to show girl and girl kissing scenes, them having to cut away from the Tara and Willow thing. And again, I feel like this is sort of gross in a very predictable Sander kind of way. Like, even though Sander has grown a lot, and even though I think we're seeing that a lot in this episode, obviously, yes, he's still this Xander-shaped boy who can't go very long without thinking about sex. And I think, you know, it's true to his character, even if not completely. Like, whatever. Like, that's what he thinks. Like, I feel like we're sitting here being all like, oh, he can't think like that. But I feel like it makes sense that this is the kind of dreams that he has about his friends. And then he feels bad about it. And then we're back to the basement, I guess, but before we get there, I just did also want to comment on that. I thought it was funny that he ended up in Apocalypse Now and that Principal Snyder returned, because that was one of the characters that I don't think anyone was expecting to see again.
I literally just read Heart of Darkness like 2 weeks ago for my lit theory class I'm taking, so I was like, oh, I have a whole new appreciation for this.
what is that, Heart of Darkness?
The short story that Apocalypse Now is based on.
Oh, I didn't know that. So what? Why does that have new appreciation?
Well, just Snyder is playing the character of Kurtz, and Kurtz is a character in the short story who has gone to Africa and basically gone. He's basically taken over like a tribe and is like violently ruling them in order to take all this ivory so he can have all this wealth.
Interesting. I was wondering, newbies, because the last time I watched this with someone who hadn't seen it before, they actually didn't recognize Snyder at all, and all of that stuff with him went way over their heads. But you guys knew it was him, right?
Knew it was him, but I think I knew it was him because I saw who was going to be in the episode, mm-hmm. or like in the credits. I think he was in the credits. I think he was named in the credits. And I was like, oh, he's going to be here. So that's how I knew him.
Yeah, I didn't recognize him like right away. It took a second, but after he like you fully get a shot of his face, like it kind of dawned. I was like, oh, wait, yeah, okay, I know who that is. So, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was cool. There was actually a lot of characters that they wanted to bring back for this episode, and some of them we're going to mention a little bit later on, but they also wanted to bring Larry back, and I think a couple of the other high school people that we met, and Jenny Callender was supposed to come back. So So I'm glad that we at least got some of them. And Principal Snyder, I mean, is one of those characters that you really appreciate once they're gone. I feel like that's, and you know, I mean, I'm sorry, but that is a lot of the enjoyment of Buffy is remembering what had happened. But anyway, so we're back in the basement with Xander. His father comes in. It's a full circle moment, and you sort of realize that this is where Xander is at right now. And him saying, you know, that's not the way out, pointing, you know, to his father. And I think that says a lot about who Xander is and what his ultimate fear is, which is of his father, or maybe becoming his father, becoming a part of the family that he has tried so hard to escape for so long. And a very interesting perspective for him. Giles's dream opens with a zine, sort of a fair at the cemetery, which in my opinion is an amazing scene. There's a lot of great little Easter eggs hidden in there. He has he's walking with Olivia and a pram, and Buffy is obviously dressed like a little child, and she goes up to the I am a vampire thing and throws this, you know, stake, slaying is like playing, and there's this whole really interesting thing going on for Giles here, where he is like, I think simultaneously in his head, Buffy is his daughter. Like, obviously she is like a daughter to him, but she's also the thing that is keeping him from having an actual family. You know, like, I think Olivia and the pram obviously represents the life that he could have had, that he has to leave behind and abandon for Buffy. And I think that it, I mean, obviously it's something that when you watch the show, it's there, it's between the lines, but it's kind of become text now that his relationship with Buffy as a daughter, but also as a responsibility that's keeping him from having a life of his own. It's a very interesting place to put Giles, I think, at this point in the show. Any thoughts?
Well, the dream also opens with the hypnotism, which ties back to how he hypnotizes her to in Helpless, and she loses her powers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just kind of interesting that he's going from, like, because in that way, that was essentially like when we really see how much he cares for her, and because he completely threw everything away from his job to protect her from the whole council's test. So we go from that echo and Buffy's like giggling, which is kind of very pure, to her being this child that he's looking after. So he's kind of going from this echo of everything he gave up for her to still her being her child, but her being his child in a potentially like perfect life where he has a wife and a child and everything.
Yeah, for sure. Really interesting stuff going on with Giles. It's also, I think it's just hilarious, like these past couple of episodes, it's almost like they realized that Anthony Stewart Head could sing, and now they just make him sing like totally, sometimes really awkwardly and sometimes really effectively. In this episode, of course, they have him sing again because he, obviously a big piece of his exposition is done in the Bronze via a song. And what's interesting, like, beside from the fact that it's a fun way of doing exposition and it's actually a pretty catchy song, this was actually also where Joss Whedon first had the idea of doing musical episodes of stuff. And I think it's fun to sort of see where the origin of that came from, and that actually came from him realizing that you could do exposition through singing. And I just want to share my general appreciation for that bronze scene, too. I think it's one of the few that, I mean, it's not that there isn't substance to it, but I think it's also one of the scenes that are there more to be dreamlike and to be a little bit absurdist, like Anya telling that joke on stage and the way they play with sound and the way that they have Xander and Willow say some things that really don't make sense in the context of the conversation that they're having, and Xander sitting there and Giles singing "Don't Bleed on My Couch, I Just Had It Steam Cleaned" and stuff like that. All of that stuff that's going on, I think it's pretty genius and it's pretty funny. even without sort of having 3, 4, 5 different layers of meaning beneath them. Did you guys enjoy that scene? Or
yeah, I mean, it's definitely entertaining, especially like, you know, people in the audience like cheering him on for this nonsensical, like, weird lyrical mess. Like, you're like, what is even happening? But I mean, it's a dream. You expect it to be a little off and things to be a little weird. So yeah, no, it was definitely entertaining.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And this was the most enjoyable part of the episode for me. I actually chose this as my favorite scene. Because of this was, it was enjoyable. It was entertaining. It wasn't hard to understand. It wasn't hard to like see why it was happening. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, this was definitely like that, kind of like what I just said, like this was kind of the most straightforward, devoid of deeper meaning scene. And so in that way, I guess it's pretty go-to-able, and which is nice, and it's a good break.
You also have Giles, like, in his dream, basically, it seems like he's trying on different identities because he's been so lost this whole season that Buffy is, like, he's no longer her watcher. She's in college. Does she really need him? He's been trying to figure out what to do with his life. So we see him in different kind of identities, which ties into the very end of his dream, but, like, you know, watcher, father, rock star, like, who is he? And then at the very end, we get him finding the watch, and he says, that was obvious. So, like, he needs to be the watcher. But, like, this scene is him, like, trying on a completely different identity of saying, like, or is this who I should be?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you're right. And finding the watch, I think you added that in, and that's so important too, because again, this seems so on the nose when you talk about it, like, duh, he's untangling the wires and finding the watch. Oh, it's so stupid. But it's also just a really nice visual clue for where the character is and what he wants and what his problems are. And yeah, saying that was obvious and so good. Moving on now to Buffy's dream real quick, and then we have a lot more stuff to talk about. The Buffy's dream has a lot of really interesting things in it. One of the key things is we get another reference to Faith, the Faith dream that she had earlier on in the season, or even
that was the dream
at the end of season 3, right?
Wasn't that the dream Faith was having?
Right.
How did she know that Faith had that dream?
Exactly. Slayer stuff, mythology, oh my god. And of making the bed. And obviously Faith is not here, which is unfortunate because they actually tried to get her for this episode as well, which would have been amazing, but it ended up having to be Tara. And actually, if you're wondering why Tara played such a big part in this episode, it's because they pretty much gave her the parts of everyone who was supposed to be in it who couldn't make it, which is interesting in itself. But so we get a bit of some very, I would say, probably the episode's most layered bit of foreshadowing and or bit of exposition or whatever you would call it, when Tara sort of says to Buffy the line, "You think you know who you are, what's to come, you haven't even begun." And then Buffy leaves and she goes, "Be back before dawn." And I think there's a lot to love about this line if you're a Buffy fan, and there's a lot to unpack. But I think at the end of the day, like, for me, the thing that I love most about it is that it speaks to so many different parts of Buffy's journey and to the audience. You know, I think it says, it's obviously speaking about the Slayer mythology. You know, you think you know what you are, in that you think you know what a Slayer is. You think that you know what your role is. You think you know who you are as a person, as a this balancing of two Buffys. You think you know what's to come. You think you know what your role is going to as a Slayer is going to be. You think you know where the story is going to go from here. You haven't even begun. Also, pointing to the fact that there's so much story left, and there's so much so much growth left for the show and these characters, and it sort of, it speaks to some very specific developments that we obviously can't get into, but I watching it, and again, you know, when it's kind of like, again, I keep comparing the show to Harry Potter for a reason, because I think just like with Harry Potter, it's even better the second time you read it, because you pick up on some stuff that you didn't realize would be important the first time you read it, that adds some layer to the story that makes you think that J.K. Rowling is a genius, aside from just being a good storyteller. And I think this is exactly the same. I think, you know, you go back and you watch the line and you're like, holy crap, like, I had no idea. And I love that. And it was almost my favorite line, but it's not.
I thought it was going to be. I was sure you were going to pick that.
I had it, but then I was like, no, because it works. Like, we should mention it in her dream, so it makes sense here. But it's secretly my favorite line.
Well, I would want to ask the newbies what they think is to come. Like, what might be foreshadowed from this line? What are your theories?
In lieu of a theory, I have a question. In previous seasons or previous episodes, to me, it's been made clear that Slayers don't live very long. Is mm-hmm. this, and I don't know if you can answer this or not, but I guess my question is this prophecy specifically for Buffy, or is it the general trajectory of a Slayer that it's like, you don't know where this is going to go? And if it is a prophecy mm-hmm. just for Buffy, like, what sort of powers are there? Are the powers that, I guess the powers that be, that are non-existent but still existent, like injecting themselves into this to give a sort of future prediction? I'm just curious as to if it's Buffy specific or Slayer specific.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know.
That's a good question.
Okay, that's a valid question.
No comment. Okay. But it's a good question. I think it's safe, and it's actually asking where it's coming from is something that I've never really thought about before, because I think it's left ambiguous for a reason. But I would say, considering that Tara is literally the voice of the Slayer, the first Slayer later in the episode, I think maybe, like, the first Slayer is the source of all these dreams, right? Like, this is the Slayer power is powering all of this. So I think, and Caitlin, please correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I feel like it's coming from that. Like, it's coming from the Slayer source, but it's also not. Like, I don't know.
Well, yeah.
Very interesting.
I've read that very much as it coming from the first Slayer, and she has this whole message for Buffy of needing to get rid of her friends and focus on, like, what being a true Slayer is, which is death and destruction, which we hear later. So that's where I very much. So if you think about it in terms of the first Slayer is telling Buffy, you think you know who you are, what's to come, you haven't even begun. That's interesting.
It's very interesting. And the final point that I had for Buffy's dream, and then we'll move on to the sequence with the first Slayer, is that Buffy's mother, obviously, we see her briefly in the wall, and she's sort of trying to, Buffy is like, oh, are you okay in there? Like, what's happening? Like, kind of distracted, kind of wanting to help her. I feel like, obviously, like, one of the things that this signifies is that Buffy is feeling like she has forgotten her, she has abandoned her, like, part of her is not, like, because obviously Joyce has been very absent this season, and Buffy almost let her die at Faith's hand, and there's obviously, again, a lot to the scene, but I think one of the things that is that it's sort of a visualization of Buffy feeling like she's abandoning her mother, if that makes sense. Is that fair to say? I actually really like that little part too.
I think it's also kind of worth noting, though, that while she feels like her mother's trapped in the wall, and she clearly feels like her mom's not panicking about her mom's fine with it, she kind of has made peace with the fact that Buffy is an adult and is going to be moving on, but you also have, like, Buffy's keeping her close, like, she's in the school, she's not, you know, it's not like we were transported to some unknown place or to a place that Buffy doesn't go every day. Like, her mother's still there and still present, just not, she's not someone she sees all the time. It's, she's not walking around the halls. She's trapped in the wall. So I thought it was like it kind of interesting that while Buffy seems to be separated from her and it feels like the literal wall being built between them, like Joyce doesn't necessarily see it that way.
I feel like the most telling part of that sequence for me is the very end when Joyce is like, well, you know, I bet you could break through if you wanted. And Buffy's already kind of started ignoring her and walking away. Mm-hmm. So she, like, you could make our relationship stronger. And Buffy's like, I have other things to worry about.
More important, more pressing mm-hmm. things. Yeah, for sure. Okay, so let's move on to the sequence of the first layer, which is something I think it's easy to forget, but I guess this is something brand new introduced to the show. This is the first time that we get the concept of where the Slayer line began and what a Slayer really is. We've had other Slayers and Watchers. We've had them say things like, you know, you're not supposed to have friends. You're supposed to be a warrior. You're supposed to be like this force of stopping the darkness. But we've never actually had made literal the concept of the Slayer, like the quote-unquote Slayers being a pure warrior or a killer, as I think it's Riley who calls her in this episode, rather than a human being who, as Buffy says, walks in the world. You know, there's a really interesting thing with obviously the first Slayer happening in this episode is that for most of the episode, it's presented as this danger, as this terrible source of death that's coming after them. And, you know, we have this wonderful, I think, telling scene of Buffy when she's talking to Riley and Adam, saying to, you know, Buffy's there and the Slayer is in, or the first Slayer is behind her, and she says, "We're not demons." And she's obviously talking about her and Adam, but she's also talking about her and the other Slayer and the Slayers in general. And it's Buffy trying very hard. She has been through the whole show, but also especially in this episode, trying very hard to hold on to her non-Slayer-ness, to hold on to the part of her that is someone's favorite quote, so I'm not going to say it, but that walks in the world, that is a human being that has other desires and wants and needs and you know, sources of happiness than being a killer of demons. Because being a killer of demons kind of makes you a you know, what does that make you? We also get the revelation, I guess, that there have been Slayers since the very dawn of humanity. We have the line from Giles saying, "Women and men have behaved this way since the beginning of time," which is obviously talking about Slayers and Watchers. We have this notion that the first Slayer, who is this supposed to be this prehistoric woman, like the first human beings on the Earth, she was one of the first people, and she became the first Slayer. It raises some questions, like, how did she become a Slayer? Why did she become a Slayer? Who made her a Slayer? All of these are questions that we don't necessarily have answers to. And I'm not necessarily looking for answers right now, but I think it's interesting to talk a little bit about.
Or was she made? Or was she born that way?
Was she born a Slayer? Yeah. Maybe she was born a Slayer. Yeah. What do you guys think, newbies?
I think it's a lot to process.
Yeah, basically that's where I'm at too. Like, I looked at the embodiment of the first Slayer as more of like I know she was like supposed to be the first Slayer, and that was the idea of the episode. But in my brain, it almost made more sense to think of it as like everything in Buffy that is the Slayer. Like, this is what the Slayer side of her is trying to tell her all the time. And so, mm-hmm. like, kind of, you know, seeing it from that perspective and, like, thinking about... So I didn't really get to the, you know, how did the first Slayer come about? But thinking, you know, like, how does something like that come about? Like, it's one of those... questions that you, I don't know if you ever do get an answer. Like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some might say it's better without an answer, though I would not say that, but I'm sure some people would. no, it's true. And it also, I mean, if you look at like the development of the Slayer mythology in Joss Whedon's brain, when he made the, or I guess he didn't end up making it, but when he wrote the first Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie, the Slayer was actually she was reborn in every generation. Like the Slayer and the Watcher were the same people that were reborn like once per generation. And obviously in this incarnation, the Slayers are all different girls that are quote unquote chosen with the power. And if we look at this, the first Slayer as the source of that power, then you could say in a way she is all of the Slayers, like all of the Slayers that are born with this power are born with her power. So they are, she does embody a part of them, if you will. And I think that's a very interesting concept. And also because, again, this has clearly been in the mind of Joss and the writer since the very beginning, because you can go back and see build up to this through the whole show so far. But this is the first time that we're truly seeing the source of Buffy's power and the thing that the purpose that she was meant to serve, or that the first Slayer believes she was meant to serve. Like, why she was a Slayer was to be a killer. It was to be alone and to be death and darkness and whatever that quote is that I wish I'd written down. And Buffy, in a lot of ways, like we've seen this with Kendra and we've seen this with Faith, Buffy, in a way, is the, as far as we know, is the first Slayer to break from that, to say, I don't want to be, like, I want to be the Slayer, but I also want to be Buffy. I don't want to be just that. When we saw her and I guess that kind of brings into my next point, which is the question is whether the reason Buffy is allowed to be just Buffy is because of her friends. You know, in this episode, we see a lot of her, you know, she has to find her friends. Her friends give her the power. Her friends are the source of not her friends are the source of the other half of her power, of what makes Buffy Buffy and what makes her more than, like, what means she has survived for this long. There's so much to this, you know, in a way that when we saw her in The Wish, which was Cordelia's dream episode, Buffy was more like Faith. She was more like the Slayer that the first Slayer probably would have wanted her to be. But because she has her friends, because she refuses to give up on her friends, even when the first Slayer tries to physically cut them out of her life, no pun intended, like, she still hold on to that side of her. I think there's so much going on here with that. I find it very fascinating.
And she's also the only Slayer to, like, survive this long. So it makes you wonder, like, you know, maybe it's not in her true nature, but maybe it should be.
Mm-hmm.
That she has other people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And The Wish is also the only time we've really seen Buffy, like, completely defeated, because she has her neck snapped by the Master. And, like, every other time, like, she survives because she has those friends. So it's, you know, for her, that is, her friends are what keep her alive.
Yeah, literally. And I think the show makes that very clear. And it's sort of, it again, this is just another, I think, affirmation that without Buffy, she even said earlier this season, she was like, I guess that's why there was no chosen prophecy about the chosen one and her friends, you know, all dramatic. And then in the end, what did she need to defeat Adam? She needed her friends. They needed to literally become one. And that was an affront to the Slayer, the source of the Slayer, because she was meant to be alone. There's so much here. One thing that I really don't like about this episode, like, I love it, but it's no way perfect, is that the first Slayer is not really allowed to speak for herself. Because I think, you know, that Tara had to speak for her, and even like thinking that, it was supposed to be Angel actually, but they couldn't schedule it around David Boreanaz. Cordelia was also made to show up, by the way, which would have been cool. But I don't know. I guess what they were going for, like, obviously, like, looking at this episode objectively, you understand that the first Slayer the reason she looks and behaves the way she does, she's meant to be like, and first of all, an early human, you know, and she's meant to be this almost like verging on being like this, a killer, you know, like this thing that kills and you know, and I think that's fine. But I kind of wish that they allowed her to speak for herself, because I feel like when they put in Tara as the one who speaks for her, I feel like it leaves a little bit of a sour taste in your mouth, if you know what I mean. Like, I kind of feel like they should have made her, I don't know, does that make sense? Like, I feel like they should just have made her sort of articulate her own points.
I see what you mean, but I assume what they were going for is because she was such an early, like, she lived so long ago, it was prior to the development of human speech.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I do sort of intellectually understand that. I just think it's worth pointing out, you know, because, like, yeah, it's a criticism a lot of people make about this episode, and I think it's totally valid criticism.
If I may, I think it also had a slightly different effect on me, because they kept using Tara throughout the episode, and because for some reason I have it in my mind that she has something that she's not sharing, like, she's kind of an ambiguous character to me. It made me feel it made me feel almost like Tara was maybe putting words in the Slayer's mouth rather than actually translating everything the Slayer was saying. I don't know. It seemed very, like, if you have a person like this, I've seen it before. There's like a villain who's translating for someone, and they'll throw in their own biases or their own ideas into, and like the person who is speaking doesn't know any different. So that's kind of how it felt to me, because I feel this way about Tara ever since she ruined some sort of spell or didn't let a spell go through, like way back in the beginning of season 4. Mm-hmm. That happened, right? That was a thing.
Yes, it did happen.
So since then, she's been this ambiguous, not great character to me. So to have her narrate the full way through, and then to have her like take the words from the Slayer and give them to Buffy, it seemed like to me that there is an extra something in there that maybe shouldn't be.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I was just going to say, I can definitely see their, like, because Tara is so mysterious, like questioning, like, whether she has some ties to, like, the Slayer line or to something similar. Mm-hmm. She's related to something in that way. I can definitely see that. I never that's interesting that you interpreted that she might be changing some of the words, though. That's interesting.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's definitely a point to be made, and I think that I've made that too prior to starting this podcast, that the show maybe, I mean, we'll have to see where it goes, obviously, but I think that it's a totally valid point to say that depending on how Tara's story goes from here, if they maybe overstated her importance a little bit, but maybe not, maybe, who knows? I mean, we'll have to wait and see, but I think it's a really fair point to make. So before we get into our favorite scenes and favorite lines, I just wanted to ask, I mean, we kind of touched on this a little bit. As a finale, I still maintain, I think it's one of the best finales and episodes of television ever, in my opinion. I've watched a lot of television. I think the reason that this stands out to me so much is because for me, at the end of the day, it makes me feel like watching TV is worth it. Which I know it seems like a big thing to throw out into the universe, but it's stuff like this that makes me feel like, and it's the reason I like TV more than movies. It's because I feel like I am watching a story unfold slowly, and it's okay that I don't have all the pieces yet. It's okay that I know that I can come back to it and pick up something more. It's the reason that I love Harry Potter so much, and it's the reason that I loved Lost until the finale, which I feel like ruined everything. It's because I feel like I am asked to do more than just sit back and watch. And I think there are plenty of shows that I love that don't make me think as much as Buffy does, but I think what Buffy does for my brain has been very good, and I'm still waiting for a show that gives me that same experience. And I think this episode really captures that for me. Like, this is what I love about Buffy. And at the same time, you know, watching sort of, like, knowing, like, that some people obviously, like, don't feel the same way is, like, totally fine, because not everyone is going to love it. But I think this episode also just being so much about the characters, I think it's pretty fair to say that if you don't like this episode and if you don't like the show so far, you're not going to like the show. And, like, to be honest, like, I'm not really even sure, like, why you would spend your time watching it now if you don't like it. Like, not this episode, but the show so far. Like, not you guys, but people in general, because I feel like it would be a waste of your time, because this is what Buffy is, and I think that it's not going to be... You're not going to like what comes next, necessarily. So if anyone's watching along with us and kind of feeling like, what's the... Why the hype? Like, by all means, keep listening, but I would warn you that you're probably not going to like it, and that's okay. I mean, it's totally fine. People like different things. I don't know if you have anything about that, Caitlin.
I mean, I feel like if you're into season 4 of a show and you don't like it, you've wasted a lot of time. So.
Exactly. There's a lot of hours of TV you could have spent watching something else. And so kind of, let me see if there's anything else I wanted to capture on this. Yes, the characters, where we are right now. Right now, what this episode does is all of the characters are facing a big... We're at a pivotal point for each of the four main characters, and they're facing a big inner dilemma. And I will just sum it up so we're clear. Buffy's is the Slayer versus being a normal girl. What part of herself is going to win out in this inner battle that she has? For Giles, his dreams was all about wanting to be a watcher versus wanting to have his independent life, him having to make sacrifices for Buffy and sacrificing his own life, whether he felt like that was worth it. Willow's, as we talked about, was this confident new person that she's become versus her authentic self, whether who she is now is a disguise or whether it's really her, and what kind of secrets she might still be hiding, and what kind of secrets she might not even be willing to acknowledge to herself in her dream world. And then Xander's, who is the clearest one, which is obviously him feeling inferior to all of his friends, uncertainty about where he is in life, and how he's going to get out of this situation, if he's going to be able to move forward, get out of the basement, so to speak, and literally. It's been building through season 4. It's now, the subtext has now become very literal text. And moving forward, the question, I guess, will be how they will each actively tackle this conflict that they are facing, that we have now been made privy to as an audience. It's an acknowledgement that everything we've seen on the show so far is intentional, and it's an acknowledgement that the show is going to continue to stay true to who these characters are at the core of their beings, and their inner deep questions are going to come to the forefront. Favorite scenes? Caitlin? No, wait, hold on, let me see. Yes, Caitlin, what was yours?
Mine was the meeting where Buffy finds Riley and the human Adam, because I find that there's just something poignant to me about seeing Adam, like, prior to him mm-hmm. being this created monster, and this whole thing where he is speaking both for himself and for the first Slayer when we see her behind Buffy, like, and she asks, like, you know, what was your name? And he's saying, like, no man can remember. And that's literally both Adam and the first Slayer. And so I just, mm-hmm. I find that whole thing, plus it's kind of funny where they're, like, poking fun at the government and being like, we're spending all our time, like, naming things, and we're going to take over the world with coffee makers that think. Like, I don't know. I'm amused and also find it just sort of kind of poignant.
Yes. And of course, I was almost going to quote Kristen's favorite line, but that the like objectively best line of the episode is also in there. Danielle, what was yours?
Mine was, we had already talked about it, but it was Giles' expository song. For all of the points that we made earlier, I like when expository things are obviously, like, they know that they're putting out a lot of story, but they do it in fun ways. And that song was definitely it for me.
Yeah, Definitely. And Kristen?
Yeah, we talked about this before, but I loved the bit of Xander's dream with Giles and Spike on the swings and Buffy in the sandbox. Just the whole idea of that really worked for me. I don't know. It's just the one part that stands out as being really fun and kind of like totally absurd, because you're laughing at this version of Spike in a tweed suit. And, you know, like just all of that, the visual of all that, it was really, really funny. So,
Yeah, it's funny, and they pack a lot of meaning too into that scene, and a lot of Xander's feelings about these people. And my favorite scene was everything to do with their botched version of Death of a Salesman. First of all, like, I love, because I experience this a lot because I'm foreign, so a lot of things that people know, like, I have no idea about. So people will, like, call out something really iconic, and from the name, I will make up something totally random in my head. And I feel like for someone who has never read Death of a Salesman, this is, like, what they might imagine that Death of a Salesman would be. And I love that. I love Harmony. I love... that Danielle's kind of has a line that goes off from there, but I loved Riley being a cowboy. Like, I loved that. Like, this is literally his character, and it's literally how Willow sees him, I think. Like, he's just the cardboard cowboy guy. Like, that's all he is. And I love that. And I love, that all those lines they had, like, Buffy's huge exposition, and then, like, men and your sails, and Riley was like, I'm looking for a man, a salesman. Like, all of that was just amazing, and everything. I love it when TV shows put on fake plays, and this was definitely my favorite. And I feel like we have not mentioned the cheese guy once, and that is appalling, and I apologize on behalf of the humanity. The cheese guy showing up everywhere was amazing, and exactly as random as you want it to be, and I don't even care. I love it so much. Favorite lines, Danielle, why don't you go, since that kind of goes on from there?
Sure, yes. I just loved the repeated line of, I showed up on time, so I get to be the cowboy guy.
Yeah.
And just to be clear, there's no cowboy in Death of a Salesman.
No, if you have not, I have actually read it.
So I have not. I know nothing. I assumed that was the case, but I mean, if he gets to be the cowboy guy, let him be the cowboy guy. He was excited.
Do you imagine that Death of a Salesman is something like this?
I imagine Death of a Salesman. I get it mixed up a little bit with, what is it? How to Succeed in Business. So I imagine them to be like the same thing.
No.
Death of a Salesman is much more depressing.
Oh, well.
Yes.
Well, there you go. See, I know nothing about it.
It's definitely no cowboys or anything.
Or milkmaids or anything. No.
Okay. So Kristen, what was yours?
Mine comes from that Adam Riley scene, and you hear the computer say very calmly, the demons have escaped. Please run for your lives. And then Adam says, this could be trouble. Riley says, we'd better make a fort. And Adam goes, I'll get some pillows. Pillow forts solve everything. Like, they really do.
This is one of the lines that I think are quoted the most, like, through pop culture, like, it's everywhere, and it's so, so funny. And I don't even know if it comes from Buffy. Like, I don't know where it comes from, but it's just so good. And I love it, and it's amazing. And, oh my God.
And it's kind of telling that Buffy thinks that Riley is going to solve a problem by building a pillow fort. It's a little telling about how she sees him as useful in an issue.
In general, I feel like this is very telling, like, about Buffy's psyche, how she views Riley, and also a little bit of, like, even though in the beginning of the episode we had him go off, like, and she was like, oh, that's fine, la la la, but this sort of maybe shows a little bit of fear that this is, like, conspiring with Adam behind his back, like, even though we figured out that was all a ruse, I think it says a lot about her. Anyway. So my quote was sort of and I feel like a lot of the commentary on Apocalypse Now in the episode was also a little bit of a breaking the fourth wall commentary to the viewers slash to the future podcast people. When they're talking about how, Apocalypse Now, like, I remember that it gets better. and Giles going, oh, I'm beginning to understand now. It's all about the journey, isn't it? And I think, like, first of all, this episode, it's very unstructured. Like, it's all about the journey. There is no beginning, middle, and end, to this episode. And in general, I think the show, it's about the journey. Like, at the end of the day, it's that simple. It's about watching these characters grow and change and learn and fail and break apart and put themselves back together in 100 different ways, and that's it. And that is also, like, I think directly what this line is saying, and I appreciate that. And let's end with Caitlin's, because it's a very telling line too.
Yes, so mine is during Buffy's confrontation with the First Slayer, and through Tara, the First Slayer says, "The Slayer does not walk in this world," to which Buffy replies, "I walk, I talk, I shop, I sneeze. I'm going to be a fireman when the floods roll back. There's trees in the desert since you moved out, and I don't sleep on a bed of bones." So there's the whole Buffy is living in the world, which is what Slayers were not meant to do. And the world has changed since the First Slayer was killing monsters. And she is living in that world, and she is going to be, you know, the Slayer, and she's going to be Buffy. And that's just what she's going to do. And that's a really powerful sentiment from her. And it just shows how different she is. And her difference is what really has kept her alive longer than most other Slayers.
Yeah. She's the first one to break from the Watchers Council. And she's the first one to proclaim, you know, in this episode, the old ways, quote unquote, old fashioned. She's the first one to demand that she does this on her own terms, and she's also the one who's lived the longest, as far as we know. And it's interesting to, you know, invent this whole new character and then invent this whole normalcy within this unnatural, like, on this made up narrative, and then have this character break from that normalcy and have it feel like, oh, of course, like, she's the one who does it, like, this is normal and she's not normal, and have that make sense. And it's great. So that is the end of our discussion for Restless and my favorite episode of Buffy of all time. Thank you for listening to that. Moving on into Angel episode 122, the season finale of season 1 to Shanshu in LA, another turning point episode. In this episode, the evil lawyers hit Angel where it hurts by trying to take Cordy and Wesley. Meanwhile, Kate is no help and Angel decides he's done with stuck-up blondes. Too bad. Darla is back. I wish this show had a female lead, you guys. Anyway, but in the end, the Pancake Trio finds out that it is Angel's destiny to live and die. Okay, so in this episode, it starts with Cordelia and Wesley being worried because Angel is not worried about dying. Like, he's found out that the Shanshu prophecy is about him, that he's going to die. And Angel's just like, oh, been there, whatever. And they are trying to find a reason to live, give him a reason to live. So Cordelia goes out and buys him art supplies, which is adorable and amazing.
She's so cute.
Mm-hmm. He's so cute. Unfortunately, like, the evil, whatever his name was, had other plans. And he gives her this shot, I guess, of vision juice or whatever you want to call it. And she starts getting this constant stream of painful visions. And I guess we've seen so far the visions, like, are kind of taking a toll on her. Like, she is experiencing a little bit of the pain, or I guess a lot of the pain that these victims are, and the fear that these victims are experiencing. And she hates that. And now she's getting it all at once, constantly, all the time. And it's hard to imagine how impossible that must be, and what a burden that puts on her. I don't know if you guys had any thoughts about that.
I thought that her part of the episode was the most moving thing, and because she was seeing all of these awful things, it was just very hard to watch, but also I liked that for her. I love her humor. I like that a lot, but I like that this gave us something else for her, like to see her in a different sort of situation. And then to see her come out the other side and what she was like on the other side.
Yeah.
This is such a, it's such a cruel thing to do to her. Like Wesley just like is caught in an explosion, which is kind of just like, okay. But like Cordelia just having one vision after another is just excruciating on so many levels, and you can just see the way she's just fading away as it goes, and it's just so horrifically cruel to her.
Yeah, I know. I agree, and I really like, I really appreciate her story. Obviously, like, it deserves to be said. I think Cordelia has one of the best stories in the, or at this point, Cordelia has one of the best stories in the Buffy and Angel universe, and she's one of my absolute favorite characters. And I think this is, you know, you kind of begin to see at the end that this is a very, very, very important, you know, speak of turning points, this is a very important turning point for this character. And a very interesting, like, not only does she have, because them giving her the visions after Doyle's death could very easily just have been a device to make her quote-unquote useful. You know, they could have very easily just left it at, well, now he has a reason for keeping her around. Let's go on with solving Monster of the Week stuff. But actually, like, it's much deeper than that. And it's much more, it's not about Angel, it's about Cordy. You know what I mean? Like, it's her story. It's not his story about this other character on the show. So I really appreciate that. And I think it's hard to watch, but it also is important for where she's going to go. And for her growth, like, look at how far she's come. Look at her in the first season of Buffy, where she was a stuck up rich girl who felt a little bit lonely sometimes. And now here she is. And she literally has the burdens of the world on her shoulder, arguably in a way that Buffy never can. Without the power. And it's just so interesting. It's very, very, very poignant. Another thing that, as you said, was less poignant, but also very shocking, was that, like, this demon, after he's hit Cordy, he blows up the main set. He blows up where the show takes place, and Wesley in the process. Spoiler alert, this was my favorite scene of the episode. I was like, I've watched this episode a bunch of times, but the first like dozen times I watched it, I was so shocked, or I guess like five times or whatever. Like, it's such a, I was wondering if you guys saw that coming, newbies, or if you were like as shocked as I was.
The explosion? Yeah. I don't see how you could see it coming. Like,
no,
like Wes, I mean, after what happens to Cordy, you kind of see that Wesley's not safe either. Like, you kind of expect something is coming for him, but I definitely was not expecting to see Angel Investigations like go up in smoke. And as like Angel pulls up, you know, in his car, parks and is walking toward the building and it explodes, like, I actually had to rewind it and do it again because I was like, wait, what just happened? Like, I didn't grasp that it was Angel Investigations that had just blown apart. I was like, seriously? Like, that just went on. So yeah, I definitely did not see it coming.
Yeah, if anything, from the look on Wesley's face when he opened the cabinet, I thought it was going to be some sort of like curse or poison or something that like takes him out. Mm-hmm. Not like him staring at a bomb and then like, I don't know. It was very strange. It was like a bait and switch, but in a very strange way. I don't know. Yeah, not expected.
What do you guys, quick fire predictions, what do you think is going to, what are they going to do now? Are they going to rebuild?
I would imagine that they're going to have to find somewhere to put him. Like, I mean, he can't be just hanging out at Cordy's all day, although it was funny when they were there, like, later in the episode, because I started, like, wondering, like, do they have him located in a specific place because of the daylight, and, like, she had all the windows open, and I'm like, what is happening? Yeah, like, I wonder if we're going to see that set again, or if, you know, Angel's going to have new digs come season two. Maybe he earned it. It would be kind of nice to see it be a little less dreary.
An upgrade, yeah.
Do you think the kids would let him sleep over?
They give more money.
Like a slumber party with the kids for a while until he can find a new place. Because they live in a dark place.
What kids?
The
guns.
Oh, those kids.
Yeah. The fighting kids. I'm sorry, I couldn't think of a more specific way to name them. The kids.
That would be cool. That would be nice. Yeah. And but so speaking of, I guess, other characters, Kate has an attitude. Angel is mad at her now. And Ariana's note, she's like, who does this bee think she is? Even if she didn't know that Angel's only two friends were dying in the hospital, the dude's apartment just blew up. Like, read the room, lady. I'm sorry, I agree with this. I think that Kate is the worst, and I feel awful about that. But, like, I think that the writers are really struggling on what to do with Kate, and I think making her... I think Angel has a really good line about this, saying, look, I know that crap happened to you. Get over it. And I think that where Kate really suffers is that, A, she doesn't have enough airtime to really develop, so she literally just comes in to antagonize Angel. And B, we just see so many other characters deal with equally big tragedies in a more proactive way. So I think by comparison, like, Kate's reaction is actually totally normal, but she just suffers because we are used to seeing characters deal with this kind of stuff differently. You know what I mean? Like, in a way, like, I like having her there because it's kind of like more realistic. But it also is kind of, unfortunately, starts to grate on me a little bit because, like, I kind of feel like Angel does, you know? Like, she just comes in to shout at him when he's, like, trying to deal with other stuff.
Yeah, Angel's very, like, up until that moment where she's berating him outside of his blown-up apartment. Like, he's very understanding of her issues and, like, how she's feeling. But at that point, he's just... He has two friends who are so hurt, and he's just like, okay, I can't deal with you projecting your issues with your father onto me, like your father's death, like we're done. So
it was like three episodes ago, like get over it. No,
but I think,
no, but I feel like,
yeah, he was like understanding until it was just like, read the room, lady. Like,
yeah. And I feel like if this had been the Kate and Angel show, it would have been a very different discussion. But because she isn't really a main or even supporting character, like, she's basically a guest character, and she only comes in every once in a while to have this kind of altercation with him, you just have to wonder, like, where are they going with this character? And obviously, like, if you're watching it for the first time, that's like you're still waiting to find that out, and maybe season two will be very different. But for now, I think watching it right now... I get where Ariana's coming from, basically, and I wish I felt differently, but I do agree.
I would.
Are there any Kate fans?
I was gonna say, I would love to see Kate become a giant thorn in Angel's side. Like, she's already like made herself troublesome, but he's always felt badly for her. Now that she's, you know, continuing to blame him and at the wrong time, I would love, like, to see in season two or three, like, see her become his adversary, like, trying to put him down or trying to stop him, and him, like, easily taking her down with every step. Like, for some reason, I'd love to see Kate, like, try really hard to be a thorn in his side, and then have it be, like, not even a major problem for him, like, him just kind of putting her aside every time, like, no, like, you don't even begin to measure up to the things I deal with, and eventually maybe see her come around. Like, that's the only way I feel like this arc could work for Kate at all. Like, she has to kind of go further into being a pain in Angel's ass before she can, you know, come back around with as far as she's gone now into the blaming him and the just being a horrible person when it comes to Angel and everything that he's brought into her life.
Well, that's a good point. I will say, though, I feel like one of the things that I struggle with on the show Angel a little bit, and it's not that I mean, I love Angel, don't get me wrong, but maybe it's just from watching so much Buffy that I have and so many other, like, Alias and whatever, that I feel like Angel is very quick to villainize its female characters, because it's basically coming in trying to be the antithesis of Buffy, because Buffy is very conscious of reverting gender roles or reversing gender roles, has a primarily female cast. Xander is the weakest and arguably most dislikable character, least likable character. Buffy's always besting May. I feel like Angel kind of reverts that back, and it kind of has like for me an effect that I'm not really appreciating very much, which is, aside from Cordelia, the most of the women are either evil or annoying or victims. And as someone who goes for female-led shows primarily, and who only really watched Angel because I knew the characters already, it is something that I'm struggling to see past a little bit. But that said, the core trio of Angel, Wesley, and Cordelia are so likable and so lovable and so investing that I'm still loving the show. And it's not like it's a deal breaker for me, but I do think the thing with Kate, maybe the reason it bothers me so much, is kind of it kind of emblematic of the fact that Angel kind of has a bit of a problem having more than one likable woman at a time, at least right now. We'll have to see if that changes later on. But I think it takes them a while, if ever, to really get that right. Is that too harsh, Caitlin? I want to offer a rebuttal.
I mean, I've been...
I feel bad saying that.
I've been defending Kate a fair amount, because I generally like her up until she starts reaming out Angel in front of his blown-out apartment, basically. But, like, I'm intrigued by... Like, Kate reminds me of someone, like, who becomes a hunter on Supernatural sort of thing. Like, they have this horrible thing happen to them and then are going to kind of delve into the deeper, darker things. And I think that could be an interesting thing for her. But she's still stuck very much in the black and white of there are humans and then there are other things. And what she really needs is, but she's still grieving for her father. We should remember, like, it's still pretty recent, and people react to grief in very different ways. And people say a lot of things and do a lot of things that they wouldn't probably ordinarily do when they're grieving. But I think she has potential for an interesting arc of a person, a normal person, like, getting pulled into the supernatural. And she has, you know, these connections that no one else does, but, you know, she's in this state of, like, of grief and struggle that makes her do things that we don't like. And that kind of makes it hard to like her at the time. But I think, like, I kind of see the potential in that character, and it's kind of frustrating that it's not entirely being fulfilled.
Agreed. The potential is there. Absolutely. And again, on a show where she was one of the main characters, it would have been a different discussion. But yeah, no. And again, I just want to make it very clear. I'm not like dissing Angel or saying it's bad or anything, because I absolutely do not think so. But I do think it's maybe a little bit easier to like Angel on first glance, because I don't know, maybe there's a little bit of like, oh, what a cute main male character there. It's like, it's easy to sort of get like, oh, cute guys. But I do think it, in a comparison with Buffy, I think it falls a little bit short in that regard. And maybe it's just because I'm used to looking so much for female leads and female empowerment and stuff. And Buffy has its own issues for sure. but yeah, so yeah, unfortunate with Kate, but we'll have to see what happens going forward. So the Oracles are dead. How do we feel about that? Is it surprising? Are we even... did we forget about them? I kind of forgot about them. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I definitely forgot about them.
What do you think it means? Do you think it means anything, or...?
It probably can't mean great things, because, I mean, they weren't necessarily, our best friends, but they were at least, like, a force for good, so having them being taken down probably isn't a great, you know, happening. Who knows what kind of lasting consequences this will have. I'm sure it will have some sort of consequence on what's going to happen in the near future, but I honestly have no idea.
Yeah. But no, there is one thing that Angel does better than Buffy, is that there's a black character who has more than just like a few appearances so far, like Gunn, obviously. Ariana has the desire for him to become the new Kate, because she thinks that she sucks. I think Gunn, this is like his third appearance, I think. he's on Agents. He was on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I don't think he is anymore, but he's really great. I really love him. I think I was listening to another Buffy podcast at one point who was really criticizing the fact that like he is so much of a stereotype in a way, like the way that he talks and stuff. Like you can tell that he's written from a weird perspective. Like, you know, it's obviously like white guys trying to write dialogue for him and that, but I'm very glad that he's here now. And I feel like Buffy and Angel, you know, as part of that era that was only just beginning to realize that they needed minorities in the main cast. Like Buffy did LGBT and Angel did, you know, a non-white character. And I think that's really cool. And I will say I agree with Ariana. It would be nice for Gunn to take on that role, although I do think that there's also still room for one more woman. But there's potential, for sure.
I find it fascinating how quickly Angel trusts Gunn with these important things. Like,
yeah.
He doesn't know him all that well. Mm. And he...
It's almost like the script called.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, like, I think it says a lot about who Gunn is as a person that Angel would trust him in these important situations. Like, that he's the first person he thinks of to go to when he needs someone. And I think that says that tells us a lot about who Gunn is as a person.
Mm-hmm. And for now, I mean, that trust kind of extends to... You are not my friend, but go watch my friends. But hopefully in the future, I mean, that's it. It's setting up the potential for there to be something more there. And I really love that. I really love what that's sort of implying. Anyway, we get back to the main part of the story, which is really Angel trying to track down the stolen prophecy. And the guys at Wolfram and Hart are trying to bring something, raise something, whatever that may be. And Angel, you know, does a very Star Warsy move and cuts off Lindsay's hand, which is pretty crazy. And it's another very shocking moment that I don't think anyone saw coming. And it's very interesting, again, in the wake of last week's episode, seeing Lindsay is an interesting, another male character that has depth, but he's a very interesting character, and he is sort of allowed a very sort of interesting reverse hero's journey where he has the choice between good and bad, and he chooses bad. And Angel, the show, is once again showing how nuanced it is in terms of exploring evil and good within humans and not just humans versus demons. And I'm wondering what you guys think about Lindsay and his role in the finale.
I enjoy watching Lindsay, and I have liked this role reversal. I just wish we would have gotten... I know he's been interspersed and like in a few episodes throughout the season, but I would have liked to have gotten more of him sooner. Because in this... I liked a lot of the rest of this episode, but everything having to do with the law firm and what they were trying to do, all of those pieces felt like they were very concentrated at the end of the season rather than kind of going along during the season. So it didn't, I don't know if that makes sense at all, but I would have liked a little bit more for Lindsay's story to have been drawn out longer rather than having him, decide to be good, quickly decide to be bad, and then like everything happened really quickly, where it felt,
yeah,
it didn't feel as real to me. I would have liked to have been drawn out.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think it's Angel season one for sure is a very, I mean, it's not as raw as Buffy's first season was, but it certainly has a first season vibe. They are very much trying to find their footing, and I think we talked about that earlier too, how this season spends a lot of time trying to be a procedural before realizing that that's not the kind of show it wants to be. And I think people, characters like Lindsay, I think that's the reason why the stuff with Gunn and the stuff with Lindsay and even the stuff with Kate feels a little bit rushed in this last batch of episodes, because they're spending this time setting up what I think is fair to say will be a somewhat differently structured second season. And I totally, I think you're right that it comes very quickly, but again, like kind of with Buffy, like on rewatch, you are sort of rewarded because that kind of pacing stuff will matter less, and the setting up of future storylines matters more. Basically fair criticism, but keep watching is what I'm trying to say. So yeah, at the end of the episode, Cordelia emerges as a new and reformed woman. You know, she's seen the worst of humanity and now she feels ready for action, and we have to wonder how much she's really going to change. Hopefully not too much, because we love her. And Wesley reveals the truth of the prophecy. The Shanshu actually means life and death. So he will become human in order to one day die. And Ariana suspects this will happen probably during the series finale. And then the final reveal, which is Darla, everybody's favorite. Oh, no, wait. Hold on, everyone. I like her. Surprise. I think she's great. And she's back. She's been brought back. We have no idea what she is, how she is, what's going to happen, what she's thinking, what they brought her back for. It's all a big question mark leading into season two. Dun, dun, dun. Were you guys, quick reactions from the newbies, excited, annoyed? Nah.
Ugh. I hate Darla. Okay. I hate her so much. Like, why? I get why she exists. I understand her character. I understand what she is to Angel. But I was so glad that it seemed like we were done with her, just because I find her irritating and I don't like what she, like, what her presence does to Angel. Like, I just don't like how he is around her, especially with all of the growth he's done this season and like becoming a fully fledged human kind of, you know, human vampire. I don't know. But I am not a Darla fan, so I'm not happy that she's back, but I'm sure she'll be a force to be reckoned with.
But is it, you've only seen him with her though, like either in flashbacks or like in season one of Buffy. So, I mean, maybe it'll be different. Danielle, do you have anything?
I was not a fan of her in Buffy season one. When we've seen her during the flashbacks, she seemed like a completely different character. And I mean, not only because she's dressed differently, but her attitude has been different. So I guess my question is which Darla they're going to go with. The one who has been around most recently, like that version of her, which would make more sense to me if we're moving like within time, or if they're going to kind of scrap the high school prep girl looking one and kind of go back to the essence of the old one. Because again, to me, they felt like two completely different characters, neither of which I liked. But yeah, so that's kind of where I'm at this moment. It's just kind of wondering which version of their Darla they're going with, or if they're going to create yet another one. And then to what purpose?
I feel like the two actually are very the same. Like I never have any problems seeing how the flashback Darla develops into the master follower Darla. I think they tie that together very nicely. So I don't really have that problem. I love Darla. I think she's awesome. I think she's fantastic. I think that she's a really, really great character, and I, for one, cannot wait to see her back on the show, talk about more female characters, something we like, and I'm excited. Favorite scenes, I already gave mine, so Caitlin, Danielle, Kristen, why don't you give yours really quickly?
So mine was when Angel cuts off Lindsay's hand, because it's clearly Lindsay wasn't expecting. I don't think anyone watching is expecting it, because that's just not really how Angel deals with humans. And then all of a sudden he's cutting his hand off, and
it's very dark.
It was very dark. It was very intense. And I kind of loved it because he gave Lindsay the chance, like all this room to get out of this life, and Lindsay rejected it. So now Angel's just done.
Mine is the awkward guy coming to hang, just because it was great, and that's all I have to say.
Yeah. I love that. On Buffy, he would have been a main character.
Probably.
And Kristen?
Mine is that last scene where Wesley finally like translates the scroll correctly, and Cordy's like, kind of a big difference, like, what the hell? That whole thing was just really cute, and seeing them like, seeing Angel kind of get a dose of hope out of it, when at the beginning of the episode it was like, oh yeah, okay, another prophesied death, fabulous, like sounds good, par for the course. Like, it was nice to see that it may not be such a tragic prophecy.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so favorite lines. Mine isn't really a line. It's just I loved Cordelia and Wesley's donut conversation, first of all, because I love donuts, and second of all, because I love Cordelia and Wesley, and I think it was a very good explanation of what's going on with Angel's state of mind and really, like, summing up humanity. We are defined by the things we want. And Caitlin.
So
I wanted this one.
Ariana tweeted me and said this was her favorite line of the entire series, so...
So it's
Wesley's translating the prophecy and Cordelia's like, hurry up because I want to know what it says about me, and Wesley's just not having it. So Cordelia says, nobody gets my humor, and Angel just kind of without looking up goes, I thought it was funny. Like, yeah. I love it.
Summing up the two of them, they really understand each other. Who would have thought? So good. And Danielle?
Mine is a Cordelia line as well, and it kind of falls in with your conversation a little bit. And basically she said, Angel faces death all the time, just like a normal guy who faces waffles and french fries. It's something he faces every day, like lunch. Are you hungry?
So good. And Kristen?
Mine's, so it's kind of sad. It's the, when Angel's in the hospital, like, seeing Cordy completely debilitated by the visions, and he's like, Cordelia, I'm gonna fix this, promise, I'm gonna get you back, I need you back. It was such a sweet little moment for them, and like, yeah, it kind of broke me a little, but it's so well done, and I'm really glad that those two have each other, and it's just beautiful.
The connection between the two of them is one of the most beautiful things in the whole Whedonverse, I think. I love it. It's so good. Like, how they've grown from, like, what we saw in Buffy and to this, you know, their family. She even said it, Cordelia, we're family. I loved it. So good. Okay, moving on. We're almost done. Contact information. If you want to send us your thoughts on these episodes of Buffy or Angel, if you want to give us your spoiler-free thoughts about what's to come somehow, I don't even know how you would do that, you can email rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can tweet @re_watchable. You can find this post on hyperbole.com, and you can find us on Tumblr at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. And if you rate us 5 stars on iTunes, then Selena will seep into your dreams. She will, you know, I will shout at you about Buffy until you wake up. So I don't know how much of a of an incentive that is, or you can give us 5 stars if you want me to shut up about it, and please do either way. Our listener feedback, we have a couple of tweets, and then we have some, oh my gosh, we have some comments from Hyperbole that are pretty long, so let us dive straight in and go as quickly as we can. So Caitlin, Kristen, and Caitlin and Danielle, oh my god, if you go in that direction, or in that, I can't even speak English anymore, go on.
Okay, so
Caitlin starts.
We have a tweet from Mandy K, who says, finally watching Blind Date. I love Lindsay. Love him. I wonder how you feel at the very end of that episode.
This next one comes from Tucker Conley, and he says, glad we are done with season 4. I'm a fan of the earlier seasons more than the later ones, but season 5 is my favorite season. I'm glad to hear that, and hopefully I will love it too.
We also got tweets from Laura Morrow. She says, shout out to the newbies. I'm a super fan, and even though I really did love season 3, seasons 5 through 7 are some of my favorite seasons, and I hope you guys enjoy it as much as me. As for Angel, I can't wait to see what happens, because unlike some of the other seasons, I have seen no episodes, and I am not spoiled. And she tagged Brittany. She also says, I hope you keep watching, and I love your point of view. Smiley face.
And Stephanie Merrill says, so excited we finally reached this point. I can't wait to hear the newbie reactions to Restless and 501 and 2. Ha-ha, smile, and zipped mouth. And our comments from Hyperbole, we have 4 of those as well, so if we just go in the same order again.
Sure, we have one from LAG. leg. As a newbie, I actually really enjoyed Primeval. Season 4 hasn't been the best, but I thought the war in the Initiative was a very visually compelling conclusion. And personally, I loved the spell the Scoobies cast to defeat Adam. I also liked how each of the cards the characters pulled represented their role in the group. Willow was spirit, Xander was heart, Giles was mind, and Buffy was hand. The effects in Buffy and Adam's showdown were also pretty impressive. Adam as a villain and the whole initiative arc in general hasn't been the greatest, but this episode did a really good job of wrapping it up.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And our next comment from Travis says, "Hey guys, super fan here. It's really strange hearing the ugh mentality for Buffy and the love for Angel when in my circles, it's always the other way around. It could be the inconsistency of Buffy season 4, I suppose. In my opinion, both only go up from here," which brings me to my next point. Natalie mentioned the split in the Buffy fandom, and it's very true. 1 through 3 and 5 through 7, with season 4 being the bridge of growing pains. Nobody has season 4 as their favorite. Haha. Team Natalie all the way. I love 5 through 7. Season 5 is my favorite, and 5 through 7 shows the maturation of the characters, and it presents darker stories and themes. And finally, Restless. The episode count halfway mark has already happened, but Restless is very much the official narrative halfway mark of Buffy. It's an episode that gets better after you finish the show, full of character insight and foreshadowing. A Whedon does David Lynch kind of episode. The Apocalypse Now stuff makes me cry with laughter. Anyways, keep up the great work, and for newbies, the best of both shows are still ahead. Thanks. Thanks for the comment.
And then we have a comment from Vicky. She says, "I agree that season 4 as a whole is not great, but there are nevertheless really great episodes. Some of them have become real classic episodes of TV. I particularly like Something Blue, Hush, Who Are You, Superstar, and Restless. The main failure of this season is its overarching plot, as you said in the podcast. But as Buffy is first of all character-driven shows, the overarching theme instead works for me. The Scoobies are experiencing the emotional post-graduation turmoil. If you remember in Fear itself, all the thematic elements of the season are presented, particularly how and why the Scoobies will separate. Buffy's distance from family and friends and excessive self-reliance, Willow's increasing hubris, Xander's feelings of isolation and lack of direction, Giles's feelings of uselessness. Everything is there, and it's explored during the rest of the season until the climax and the Yoko factor and the resolution in Primeval. And Restless is a further exploration of their psyche."
And finally, House of Black says, "If I were podcasting about the podcast, my favorite quote would be Natalie's heartfelt cry, 'Where are Buffy's pancakes?'" I don't know what that's referring to, but I'm sure it's hilarious. So thank you so much to everybody who left your comments, and thanks for the thoughtful commentary on the show and the show Buffy and the show podcast show. And we're gonna end this week with Danielle's deliberations and Kristen's predictions on the first episode of Buffy season 5, which is Buffy versus Dracula, and Angel the first episode of season 2, which is Judgment.
I was not prepared for this.
We typically just kind of give a surface reading, like, what do you think?
I've heard him before. Please, if you have one, please go.
I mean, Buffy versus Dracula, come on. It's like the ultimate vampire showdown between the vampire and Slayer. Like, that sounds awesome. I have no idea what it actually means. I'm hoping that it's just Buffy versus Dracula, but I guess we'll find out. It sounds kind of fun, though, and I will look forward to that. Because vampires are usually pretty wimpy and, like, lame. Like, she kills them pretty easily a lot of the time, so... You know, it'd be interesting to see her go up against someone as crazy as Dracula. And as far as Judgment goes, I have a feeling this has a lot to do with the oracles and how their death is going, or the end of them is going to affect, like, Angel and his situation and how he goes forward. Something about it just has that ominous feeling. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts, Danielle?
I'm imagining for Buffy season 5, and if this doesn't happen, I'll be very upset, but like a totally classic movie showdown looking episode, like something happens and Buffy gets thrown into an old monster movie. And so you have like that Dracula, like the really over the top with the classic outfit kind of Dracula, everything's in black and white because why not? And for Judge,
like Spike was in this episode.
Yeah.
Which was funny.
Yeah. So, and for Judgment, maybe something having to do with the powers that be and like a sort of Judgment Day for Angel so that he could move forward. I don't know. That one's not as fun as like classic monster movie. So I'm just going to stick with that.
Cool. Thanks for that, guys. And that leads us to the end of the show. Thank you so much to everyone who's listened. It's been a experience talking Buffy and Angel. And you know, my favorite, two of my favorite shows of all time. And I want to thank you for putting up with my thoughts. And then I hope you will enjoy the show going forward. Until the next episode of the podcast, my name is Selena.
I'm Caitlin.
I'm Danielle.
And I'm Kristen.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.